No, you should.
No. You're doing, you're doing.
Okay, we're going to try to stay on schedule and keep this at just about 45 minutes. Before we start this final wrap-up session, I want to do one other thing, and that is to thank four additional people that I didn't mention before, and that's Rick and Angie and the two folks working the cameras here. They've been very quiet and unobtrusive, but doing absolutely central work to what was intended with this meeting, and I want to acknowledge them and express my appreciation for your patience and your good work. So thank you all. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Usually at a wrap-up session, part of the mission is to sort of develop a theme or something like that. I don't know that I'm competent to do that, and I would much prefer that we just spend this time trying to get the remaining questions out on the table, especially from some of our guests who've been very very patient with us in the format. Jim, you...
No, I have an additional suggestion.
Okay.
I think I'd like to hear from the, also in the course of this questioning, from the legislative directors here, what we haven't talked about that we ought to have, if anything.
Are there any questions that we haven't asked that we should have?
Well, Larry Stein did make a good point in our discussion at lunch that the press, the relationships with the press as they affect the legislative process. And, I mean, I would add to what was said a little earlier that it's not uncommon today for members of Congress to communicate to each other through the press. Of course, where 25 years ago, senators might have shared an idea or a thought when they would sit in the members-only dining room and have lunch on a daily basis, but now it seems in many cases the preferred channel of communication is a leak to the reporter covering that issue, or that's become that's really dramatically altered the communications landscape, I think.
Did you talk as well about the sort of the impact sometime when the Legislative Affairs Office would sort of use the press as a mechanism to get senators or congressmen on the record about issues that you really, really wanted to get them locked in on so that you could have, a carefully planted question asked at the right time might elicit the kind of response that you needed to lock somebody down. So that element as well.
Did you do that very often, Fred?
Fairly often. Or, it wasn't something that happened every week, but I mean, it was something, and it really, again, it, all of these circumstances, I think, that we've discussed vary by issue, from issue to issue, and level of importance, and all those kinds of things. but it was with some regularity. Because you'd get the other kind of question. The media, the guys in the press would ask us, well, X. And this was in our independent relationships with. And so, you might respond by saying, well, why don't you go ask so-and-so why? And then you might find out the answer to that question. So,
is it fair to say that each of you studiously avoided having your names appear in the newspapers? I know in doing the research, putting together the briefing materials for conducting interviews with legislative directors, it's quite a chore because you guys don't leave a long paper trail.
That's by attention.
Not the way we, we were brought up. Now, Callie is not here, so.
Just kidding. Strike that from the record.
That's just a joke. No, but I think if you want to be effective in this business, you have to, the members have to know that what they say to you is going to be kept in confidence and shared with the president if necessary, but not. You're not, and if you're in the paper every day making observations and comments, then you're not going to be able to retain that trust.
See, and I never thought I was smart enough to be able to figure out the effect of what I was saying to a reporter on the intended target. I give you a case, and this wasn't me, but the White House press secretary traveling with the president. There's a vote going on, and reporter saying, well, how can the president really doesn't care about this issue, he's off traveling. And he said, well, no, the president's engaged. He's making phone calls. Well, who's he making phone calls to? So he told them. laid out the names, one guy in particular. You know, we've got him very, very close to taking a politically difficult vote. And there it is publicly. The president is pressuring him to do it.
That's no fun.
And the only way I could think to retrieve this, because it was not, is I just went directly to his office. I walked in there, and he just sort of looked at me and said, "You SOB, I knew you'd show up." I was going to yell at you on the phone. I can't yell at you in person. But there was somebody using the press for one purpose, for another, you know, and it was completely counterproductive. So I think that's a bank shot that I'm not comfortable with.
Chuck.
Along this line, it seems that increasingly in the presidency, issues are approached via a communication strategy, an overall concept of how this thing is going to be sold that may include congressional relations, but certainly isn't limited to it. To what extent do you people have experience with being included in a communication strategy, integrating your activities with what the communications office or the press office are doing to try to push an issue at the same time?
Ours was daily. I mean, we did the, at our senior staff meeting that we had each morning, which was generally chaired, which was chaired by the chief, it was the senior most folks. So it's a guy who's got communications, it's the press secretary, it's the domestic policy guy, the national security guy, me, and whoever else was in that group. And that's where we sort of began the coordination process, what the message was going to be for the day, how it was going to fit into the process. And then later on during the day, other members of our staff at different levels would participate in that process. There were other issues such as clean air, for example, where we were not only building a piece of legislation that we were going to roll out and introduce in Congress, but also trying to get members of Congress to be involved in the legislation while it was being drafted by us. And part of our strategy in that one was to build it around four or five principles, for example. And that was going to be our standard in terms of whether or not we were going to veto it or not, or accept changes to it. So it was kind of like the messages were within those four or five principles, and that was the sort of the touchstone that we used throughout that process. Just one example.
The first question about taking press calls, we instructed, this was in the Reagan administration first term, if a congressional relations person got a call from the press, they were to refer it to the press office. And also notify, let us know that they'd gotten a call so we could be aware of it. The second question about are we included in the communications loop, that was an integral part of the legislative strategy group when it was formed early in the Reagan administration by Jim Baker. It would be, of course, the chief of staff, congressional relations director, Darman representing OMB, and Stockton would be there, Dave Stockman representing OMB, and Dave Gergen with the communication. So that was all coordinated. And in the senior staff meeting in the morning with the president, it would be practically the same group. So there was nothing that we were doing that communications was not aware of. There was nothing that the press office was doing that we weren't aware of. So everybody had a knew where the other office was at, so it it worked pretty well.
So very similar for us, but I to two points. I think you can overestimate the amount of long range planning. A lot of it is sort of making it up on a daily basis. Even if you're sitting around 8:30 and decide, okay, the president needs to go out at 11 o'clock and make a statement on this or that. And there are a lot of other forces and interests surrounding the president rather than just what's going on up on the Hill, and breaking news and whatnot. But I think an interesting focal point is the Saturday radio address, begun, I think, by President Reagan, which to watch that evolve during the week. Yeah, I was probably thinking about it Tuesday, what are we going to do? And it changes throughout the week. And the great thing about it is you don't have to have it, it's relatively short, and you don't have to have it final until the president puts the mic in front of him. You're live. So, I mean, sometimes, change overnight, Friday night, you go home and you think it's on this.
You hear it the next morning.
Nope, it's on that.
Did those messages resonate with members of Congress? Did they pay attention to them? Or?
Well, they must have. There's some impact. I don't know whether they resonate, but they started responding. Whether or not they respond to the subject matter or not, which is normally not the case, they started getting their chance to be on this. So they designate people. The problem is that they don't have one person. And so it sort of goes all, do they resonate? Depends upon whether the people who hear it on Saturday pick up the phone and make a phone call, meaning public, or whether or not they're willing to, write a letter and start beating up on somebody because their president said, you're holding up my judges.
I just want to say on I think in the current White House strategies, there is and has been for some time integration, pretty good integration, with the media communications and legislative strategy among the professionals using state-of-the-art, increasingly state-of-the-art techniques. But there is tension, I think, in that relationship. And we would find, I think, as practitioners of getting votes, we would find ourselves frequently in disagreement with the communication strategists who, of course, since it's their business, they think communication strategy is the answer to all issues. And in their view, there was not a single issue that could not be won if Ronald Reagan simply gave an address from the Oval Office in prime time. And so it was just like every week someone, a cabinet officer or a senior member of the staff, would say, well, this is an important issue. We've got to have a presidential address. And so as a practical, when you assess the impact of that on the issue at hand, you find yourself in this position, I think, frequently having disagreement with that, the role of that. And President Reagan developed a justifiably reputation for being a great communicator on TV in that setting. It was not something you would want to put to use too frequently. But because it was generally effective, it was sought time and time again, even by judicial nominees. And there is tension there that's probably healthy. And when you're down to counting 6, 8, 10 votes, there's only so much that a communication strategy is going to do for you when you get right down to individual vote, senators and Congress.
Sometimes with regard to the effectiveness, there was a radio address today. I don't think, okay, fine. Will we ever know what it was about? I probably not. So it might not have, and we frequently said the amount of work we put into it far surpassed the sort of the public reaction to it. But members of Congress, when you're working a big issue, do look at what the president has said. How often, I mean, it can't matter to him. He hasn't said anything about it for 3 weeks.
Well, right.
Especially when they're your guys telling you that. It's like, he really doesn't
mean it. And you hear that enough and say, okay, well, we're going to say something about it. And that's where it might be the next day at 11 o'clock you say something.
I think there's always been leaks up there in the White House, but I think it was perfected by Gergen and Baker during the first term. We would have those legislative strategy meetings and everybody would be sworn to secrecy. I'd pick up the post the next morning, there it was, laid right out. But they knew how to do it because the leaks they would put out were invariably favorable to us. Mm-hmm. And they got them printed, so you got to give them credit for it. They weren't just leaking haphazardly, they were leaking with a purpose.
Steve Knott.
I have a question that's a little bit out of the direction that we've been going in, but it's this whole, the conventional wisdom is that there's been a decline in civility up on Capitol Hill, and that in particular it escalated during the Clinton years. And I was wondering, particularly Chuck, if you would address this. Is that an accurate perception, and what are the sources of this decline in civility?
Well, I think civility might actually be on the rise. Fraternity might be on the decline. Yeah, affection, involvement. And you're right, this is sort of the congressional relations side of it. And I mentioned in one of these, the issue of a stable majority. And I came through, grew up on the Hill, as John Hill used the word, I grew up in the 80s, at the end of, in the last decade of a four-decade stretch. We knew we were going to be in charge forever. And in fact, working for the committee, you could look down the row and you knew there was going to be the next great chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. So let's sort of help them, teach them. Even the chairman never knew that. So you presumed, and you had the ability, I think, in translating it to the president's agenda, you had the ability, therefore, to work with the president to accomplish his goals, work it out, because the future of the party didn't depend on it. We haven't really talked about it, but the congressional Democratic cooperation with Ronald Reagan on tax reform was astounding, a huge victory for President Reagan, which ultimately passed the House of Representatives with very few of his party in support of it. It was passed by Democrats. It changed over in the Senate. In fact, Chairman Packwood and the Republicans were in charge. But that was something where Rostenkowski said, in fact, did say to Tip, hey, this is our stuff. We got to do this. And it didn't matter that, does this give Ronald Reagan a bounce and help George Bush get elected? It didn't matter. You're just doing it. But today you take the margins being so close, I say sort of say facetiously, the vote on approving the journal, this bill is so important that the speakership depends on it. So the amount of party discipline. So maybe the political scientist would say the majorities get so close, the middle has to hold. And you will govern in the middle, in the fringes of each party. No, that's not what happened, in fact. It's the fringes who control. And so that, I think, and you could, once you return to a stable majority, and I got my preferences, but, then I think you get into a different system of government where we're not talking about, the future, because you'll be there. If you don't do it this year, you'll do it next year.
Yeah, I think that's the statement. In 86 to 88, we had to work with House Democrats to get anything through there. And the Tax Reform Act of 86 was a good example of that. We had to, there was no prospect at the time of Republican control of the House, and dealing with those committee chairmen and the Democratic leadership was necessary to get anything of a revenue measure over to the Senate. And so I do think the closeness, that was a different day. Closeness of the margins today, in my personal opinion, the growth in the utilization of negative television ads that are in close districts and close races, that has contributed to the deterioration in civility and the fact that we're in this perpetual campaign we spoke about earlier. Makes it very difficult, man, to work across the aisle.
I'd add a couple other things. The aggressiveness of Congress when it comes now to issuing subpoenas and wanting to be the investigative czar, if you will. No matter which side they're coming from, and they're always aimed at the executive branch. I think that has increased substantially. Probably, it's sort of kind of post Watergate, but it sort of got into the environmental stuff back during the Rita Lavelle days, and then it's just sort of picked up a sort of steam that has not stopped. Which the guys that work with President Clinton can tell you about, and the guys that are now working for this President Bush can tell you about. So. Then on the camaraderie side, I can at least personally trace it back to the late 80s and the beginning of the Bush administration. At least I take it from that point, whether it was what happened to Jim Wright, what happened to Tony Coelho, what happened to to other members of the leadership in the Congress of the United States, and you know, and our former boss John Tower. I mean, it was that breakdown was occurring at a point in time where some of the institution is not like it used to be when I had the, I guess we can always say that about something we've once done, but back when I was there in the 70s, it was a totally different institution when I was dealing with it in the late 80s and early 90s.
I kind of take the long view on the civility thing, because it seems to me every time there's a big clash up there, they will say, this is the most partisan time we've ever had. And you know, there's so many stresses and tensions and conflicts built into the system by the founding fathers and by practice, which is a good thing, I think, that there's always going to be at times of stress, especially impeachment and war and peace, and some of the fights that Fred just mentioned. You'd go back to that time, and I guarantee you, you would find quotes from members saying this is the most partisan Congress in the history of the United States. But if you remember, you know, if you'd read history, there's nobody getting shot up there. There's nobody getting clubbed like there was in the Civil War,
right.
Beat over the head with a cane, and having fisticuffs occasionally in the lobby. So I think it overall, and I can't speak for the Clinton, obviously, or the last couple of administrations, but I'm sure that the civility, there's a lot of incivility, but I think that that's not a, I would argue that it's not on the increase. I think it's a symptom of the times and the issues that the congressmen and senators are facing.
Good point. Steve Wayne, did you have a
question? No. I have a small question. You spoke about press leaks and how that might hurt you if they indicated that the president was calling someone or something like that. Did any of you have occasion to use the press and leaking information for the purposes of trying to build support or get legislation through or getting someone who really screwed you?
Well, during the Reagan administration, and to a certain extent during the Ford administration, I did give interviews and would talk to reporters. I was permitted to do that by the chief of staff because I think he had confidence that I would not say anything that would be in conflict with the president's policy, and that I had enough judgment not to say something that would offend a congressman or senator, and also get the message in the interview of what we were trying to sell. And I think that other members of the senior staff, Baker was interviewed. You can look at the Stockman did interviews. Members of the senior staff did interviews. It all depends on the individual. You can't have everybody going out there and being interviewed constantly, but there are certain times in the legislative session when good stories by the congressional relations people help you. And then at the other end of the line, you get to know which of those press people you can talk to. There are certain people that will call you, and immediately your antenna and your hackles go up. You know, I can't say anything. I can't even comment on the weather to this person because they're going to either misquote me or they're going to put this in the worst light. There's others you know that you could be perfectly honest with. We never went off the record. That was a no-no. You either talk to them on the record or you don't talk to them. But once you learn who the responsible reporters are, and most of them were, you could talk to them, and they're trying to get a story, and you're trying to sell a product. And sometimes it comes together nicely.
And again, the guys who are in legislative affairs, too, are around these guys, because the reporters for all of the media outlets are hanging out in the same place up on Capitol Hill that the legislative people are hanging out. So there's this, they're after members to get quotes and get comments, and likewise, they sort of would be after the legislative folks. They're just sort of, in many instances, just to kind of find out what's going on. And actually, once you got the kinds of relationships that Max alluded to and developed, and you know, you found that they could be very helpful to you in figuring out what somebody else's strategy was that could potentially be your opponent.
Yeah.
I would be refunded.
There's a few of those people probably still there, like Tom DeFrank of Newsweek and Ann Compton, ABC.
Ann's still there.
And you know, they were a tool. I considered them a tool because a lot of things I could find out from Tom.
Good journalist.
Yep.
He would know things that we didn't know.
Yeah.
So it was. It certainly was not something that we avoided.
And you could talk to them, but just sharing of information, not as an official White House spokesman, you know, for the record.
I'll confess, I avoided them. And you come back from a long day on the Hill and you have 15 phone slips from members of Congress, 10 or 15 from other executive branch officials and cabinet officers, and 10 or 12 reporters. So, you know, I found a way to put those reporters at the bottom of the stack. I'm sure I paid a price for that. But it's very tough then, especially dealing with the White House press corps. And those are, they're not local folks from the Greenville News. These are tough and seasoned reporters. And you do, as Max said, you learn what direction they're coming from. But it's a difficult dimension to the job, trying to advance the president's agenda, but also do so through reporters, and I was not very good at doing that.
He would ask earlier if there was a topic that we sort of haven't covered, and it just sort of reminded me a little bit of saying coming back from the Hill. And that, I think, is the tension, daily tension in the office, decision of where to be physically.
Good point.
You know, and I have the job of deputy, house deputy, and then as assistant to the president. And and quite frankly, in some respects, the job of deputy was a hell of a lot better because I could be on the Hill when I wanted to be 80% of the time. When things were not at the White House, you just get a car and you go up there, and you know, most people happy to see you, but you know. But when you're assistant to the president, I mean, you have two houses that you have to deal with. You've got so much responsibility in the White House, these meetings that we've been talking to. Those meetings are going to occur even if you're not there. And so they make a policy decision, and you know, you're not there to say, it's not going to work, it's going to blow up, then they're going to move forward. So, but yet, you know, one of your strengths is being up on the Hill, talking to people. And that's where you get the raw data to be able to. So, I mean, I found it, and not different, but it's a constant, you know. And then you have senators and members saying, where have you been? Mm-hmm. You don't like us anymore? I mean, what's wrong? You know, well, you know, I got these things going on. And so that's a real tension, I think we all.
You can sit there all day long and shuffle paper if you want
sure
to do that.
Sure can.
And never get out of your seat. You can do that. And I saw in the Nixon administration, Bill Timmons got chained to the desk. And no fault of his, but he did get chained to the desk, and he got criticized by members. Where is Bill? Why didn't he ever come to the Hill? Well, he had a lot of battles he was trying to fight. He had to be in the White House, but I made up my mind that we were not going to get into that trap. And we had rules that the House and Senate staff should go to the Hill by 10 o'clock, whether they're committee meetings or not. Get up there and go make the rounds. And myself, I made myself at 12 noon, no matter how many phone calls, even if Mrs. Reagan was on the line.
Oh, no, come on. Don't be doing that now, man.
She might be watching.
I would get up and go to the Hill at 12 noon. And, you know, just to be seen up
just
there around
up.
The House floor and the Senate floor.
Get out of the
like Chuck says, I mean, that means all, it can make the whole difference. Because if they don't see you around there, they feel like, White House is isolated, and
right.
You know, they start talking among themselves. You can just walk through the dining room. That's all you got to
right.
do. Make
all
sure.
You do.
So it worked pretty good, and you torture yourself because when you come back in the evening, like you say, Will, you have got a stack of phone calls that takes you 8 or 9 o'clock to get to return. We had another rule: you couldn't go home until you returned
right.
all your phone calls.
Right back.
And you might have 25 phone calls. But the beauty of that is, after 7 o'clock, there's damn few people in the office. And you could leave a message, return the call, and you, what were we? But those were two inviolate.
But now there's email.
Now there's even on top of that. I can't imagine. Yeah.
Well, you had a deputy who was responsible for looking after the shop while you were. The organization I'm a little fuzzy on, but typically it was somebody who was supposed to stay pretty much anchored in the White House, right, and look after these things. Did they just not have sufficient stature to being the kinds of meetings that you're talking about you needed to be in?
They did, but they weren't the assistant.
In my sense, it depended upon whether or not it was an assistance level meeting. We did a lot of stuff where actually the person who was the internal deputy on my team, I had three of them actually during the time that I was there, had the ability to sit in a meeting and declare for us, if you will, pretty effectively from a legislative affairs standpoint. But there were a lot of those meetings. It's from judicial selection to scheduling to speech writing to domestic policy to, and even that one person had a difficult time making all of those meetings. So, I mean, it was a pretty busy day.
I had Bill Griffin was my deputy, and he had tremendous experience on the Senate side, and he's a real well-organized person. And when I was on the Hill, he was always in the White House, and he would cover the key meetings. He didn't go the Hill that much. He was there practically all the time. But we got it worked out so that we wouldn't have our judicial. Meese would call the judicial meetings 6 o'clock, 6:30. So make sure that we were back from the Hill. And Meese would sit there and talk about judges till midnight if you let him. He just loved to talk about judicial appointments and all the qualifications and why the American Bar Association was blocking this one or that one. And you were sitting there going half asleep and still hadn't got all of our phone calls returned. But he wouldn't have the meeting start until we all got back from the Hill.
We talked about the continuity in the office. You mentioned the assistant, and I guess I did have that job briefly. One day I was there, and Congressman Portman was in and around the White House with some of his friends, and he had that job, the sort of the inside guy.
He did it for me.
Right. Uh-huh. And so Portman walked into my little cubbyhole. It isn't, you know. And he said, drapes haven't changed. He said, everything is just, in fact, he turned to his friends, he said, one of those two pillows, there were two chairs that only would fit, one of those two pillows has a big yellow stain on the back of it from a magic marker. Sure enough, he went over, picked it up. And this was 10 years later. Things don't change.
Institutional memory.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
He was worthless at that job, by the way.
He couldn't keep his magic marker.
That's right.
Any other questions? Well, with that, then, we'll bring this to a conclusion. Let me once again say how grateful I am to those of you who have come down from your experiences in Washington. It has been a very illuminating experience for us, as well as being extremely enjoyable. I can't think of a group that we've met with that I've had more fun with. Too bad many of the stories that we picked up in the hallways and over dinner last night didn't get on the record, but at least we have them lodged in our memories. And so thank you for coming down and being part of
this. Thank you
guys for having us. Russ, thank you.
Thank all
of you. We should thank the Miller Center, too. This has been an enjoyable opportunity for us, and I think
It's been a two-way learning street, because I for one, I enjoy hearing about the other administrations, and
right,
ones that I didn't serve in, and ones that came before, and ones that came after. It's just been like going to school.
Anytime I ever have a bad day up on the Hill, and should I ever serve again, I'm just going to think of your
litany
of woes.
That was something. That was classic.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Russ.
That was great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.